It's January the 8th, so Happy New Year and welcome to the first Reconstruction podcast of 2025 with David Taylor, that's me, and Phil Bishop, that's you, Phil.
It is me. It is me indeed. I'm not sure we're meant to be saying Happy New Year anymore by the second week of January. I think people are fed up of hearing it.
Probably. Yes, probably. I've had people wish me a Happy New Year in late February before, simply because they hadn't spoken to me since previous year. I don't know whether or not that counts. It's probably too late, isn't it, by the end of Feb?
I think it is a bit.
Yes, it's not such a new year. Anyway, Phil, new year, new government, new God knows what else. I mean, but there's plenty to look forward to this year. So I think we're going to talk about what might happen. I don't know whether we'll make hostages to fortune in doing so, but there's quite a lot to think about. And the government's got some plans to roll out this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's going to be less of a crystal ball discussion rather than a little bit of that, but mostly be talking about what has been promised,
yes.
What people have said they're going to be doing, and we'll be looking forward at some of that.
Yeah, but heads up, yeah.
Yeah. First of all, I think it's worth giving a bit of background to the economy and what we expect. Broadly speaking, we've had, well, ever since COVID, after COVID, there was a steep sort of climb, all the graphs shot upwards, which is just a rebound effect. And then with Russia invading Ukraine and other economic ails, things sort of went a bit wobbly again. We've had a couple of rubbish years. And according to the Construction Products Association, whose team of economists seem to be as competent as anyone else's, we're looking at UK construction output having fallen about 2.9% in the year just gone. And that will turn around to a 2.5% rise in 2025, which sounds great. But of course, fall by 2.9, go up by 2.5, you're still below where you started.
Yeah, do the maths.
In terms of total activity. But, you know, growth is good. More exciting, they're forecasting 3.8% growth in 2026. And a lot of these forecasts were predicated on, and these were forecasts that they published in October, which is now 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And they're predicated on promises by the new government. And they're also before the budget, these forecasts, that's important to add, and promises to reform planning, get house building going, build, not block, and all that sort of stuff. So the question is whether the government's going to deliver, and I think that's what everything hangs on. There's a certain amount of optimism around, I think. If I just refer to the Purchasing Managers Index, which came out yesterday morning, the December survey of construction purchasing managers, still in positive territory, 53.3 in December. Anything above 50 is growing. But that's down from 55.2 in November and the lowest for 6 months. So it's the car's still going up, but it's, you know, it's all a bit sort of wobbly and fragile. More hopefully looking forward, almost 50% of the survey panel predicted a rise in output over the course of 2025, while only 15% forecasted a decline. Well, given that all the economic forecasters are predicting an increase anyway, I'm surprised only 48% predicted, you know, supported those stats.
Yeah.
I mean, 2.5 normally is the sort of growth you want to look for in the economy if it's year on year on year, but not after what we've had. You know, we need a bit of a stronger rebound, and that's not going to come yet. So I'm, you know, house building, still struggling. We can say that we know that the growth areas are going to be, I mean, commercial building, fit out, refurbing offices seems to be doing pretty well. Data centres and logistics and warehouses, that's what all seems to be going great guns. Infrastructure ticks along nicely, particularly driven by HS2, of course. House building, though, is way off, and that's where the problems are, and that's the focus of the government. And I don't see that turning around hugely within the next 6 months or more.
I think the measures announced in the budget last autumn didn't help. They certainly poured cold water on prospects for a lot of industries, not just construction. I mean, the increase in national insurance payments, employers' national insurance payments, was very, very unpopular. And I think that a lot of businesses, certainly the larger businesses, are pretty upset about that.
Yes, I mean, we talked about that at the time, didn't we?
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, there would have to be some sort of tax rise. I think, will it all come out in the wash? I do think that the next forecast we get from the Construction Products Association, taking into account the impact of the budget, I don't think they'll be quite as bullish, but they may put more weight on the planning reforms that are promised.
Yeah, possibly. Well, what else have we got to look forward to? What else has been promised? What else should the government be delivering?
Well, the various things which they have trailed in their first... we've had 6 months of Starmer now, haven't we? That were trailed in the first 6 months.
Yeah.
Months.
Yeah.
Most of them were promised in the manifesto. And I'll just run through, I think, three things which I'm particularly keen to see how they pan out. First up, sometime in the spring, which I think may be a loose definition of spring, it may end up being June, July, we have the creation of a new organisation called the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority, or NISTA. Mm. And this is basically a merger of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, which is an office within the Cabinet Office, a unit in the Cabinet Office, which essentially exists to try and kick ass of the other departments which are doing infrastructure type things, whether it's Department for Energy or Transport or whatever. And then that Infrastructure Projects Authority is being merged with the National Infrastructure Commission. And we may have talked about this before. The National Infrastructure Commission is an advisory panel.
Yeah, they've got very different roles, haven't they?
The great and the good who come up with what is supposed to be independent, sage advice for what the national plan should be for the infrastructure that the nation needs. And with it coming from these people, a bit like the climate change panel, which was set up, created by, it's got the force of law behind it, and National Infrastructure Commission reports to Parliament, is it every 5 years, every two, whatever, the statutory thing behind it. And the idea was, when it was set up all those years ago, 10, 20, Cameron, I think, was under him, was that politicians couldn't meddle and interfere and say, National Infrastructure Commission says we need HS2 to go to Leeds, therefore it has to go to Leeds. And this is exactly what a lot of construction industry lobbyists have been saying at the time. Let's get politics out of infrastructure. And now that'll happen. We've got the National Infrastructure Commission. It didn't happen. Last year, we had big construction coming out lobbying, saying, let's get politics out of infrastructure. So Labour said, we'll do that by merging the Infrastructure and Projects Authority with the National Infrastructure Commission, and that will get politics out of infrastructure. You wait till they cancel some infrastructure project or go ahead with something really controversial. That will be a political decision.
Well, infrastructure is intrinsically political, isn't it?
Of course,
we've made that point before.
Yes.
So you can't really get, you can't really take the politics out of it. I mean, clearly, when our political system means that the political climate can change relatively frequently. There's an opportunity to do it every 5 years, after all. So I think the thing that people get frustrated about is the fact that, you get a new regime or even just a new cabinet secretary making all the decisions, and what you thought was the direction of travel suddenly changes. And I think that's what people mean when they say we need to get the politics out of infrastructure. But you can't do that because people, the climate changes in response to circumstances, and so you can't
just projects go hugely over budget.
Well, yes, exactly.
Whose fault is that?
Yes, precisely. So no, I don't think you can take the politics out of infrastructure. I suppose that something like the NIC, well, I suppose it's a group of people who aren't thinking with the political hat on. They are thinking purely in terms of the long term. So perhaps the idea is that they will provide some sort of guidance for whoever is making the decisions. It's some sage advice, but of course they've got no actual power. I mean, I don't know what the merging with the IPA is going to achieve, whether or not we'll have less of that sort of political flip-flopping, or whether it'll just continue.
It'll make it worse. Let me explain how.
Okay.
With the National Infrastructure Commission, ARMIT's committee, just like the Climate Change Committee, it is essentially a body of experts which the government is supposed to listen to, but of course it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
But if they say something like, we have to ban boilers, gas boilers, mm-hmm. or we need to build 8 nuclear power stations, the government can come up with something which is really unpopular, perhaps, and say, look, this is not us saying this. Mm-hmm. This is the experts over here. This is not us politicians trying to, we're being told, this is, you know, we have it on good authority that this has to be done. Which, if you're in government, is a hugely useful tool to have at your disposal. If you don't, want to do the nasty stuff, you can ignore it.
Yeah,
if you want to do the nasty stuff, you can blame them.
Yes.
That's political, that's politics, and that's handy. They're taking the NIC, they're turning it from an advisory body of experts into a office of government.
Mm.
It's going to be part of the cabinet office. Then anything that NISTA says, you cannot say, oh, it's not government, it's this NISTA body. That's like saying it's not government, it's the Department of Transport or the Highways Agency, National Highways, whatever they are. You know, if you're bringing it further into government, you are de facto making it more political.
Mm.
That's how I see it.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. So, I mean, doesn't look as if they're going to achieve an awful lot by doing that.
Well, what may happen, what the thinking behind it, this is what the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Darren Jones, who I've got to admit, I cannot put a face to that name. I wouldn't know him if he came up in a pub and thumped me.
Which he might do after this film.
I'm hopeful. I hope he's right. This is what he visited Skanska, good British company, in October to give a speech there about infrastructure aspirations of the new government. And he was explaining what this new body, NISTA, would do. He said, this new body will get a grip on the delays to infrastructure delivery that have plagued our global reputation with investors.
Mm.
It will restore the confidence of business to invest and help break the cycle of low growth. Well, if it does that, yay, all power to it. I just don't exactly see how one leads to the other.
No. Yeah, who's going to head it up? Because Sir John Armitt, who was the boss of the National Infrastructure Committee, he's been asked to stay on until this new body is created. So, but he's not going to remain, is he? He's just sort of be handing over the baton. So who's going to be taking up the role from him?
Well, we don't know. The guy who was head of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, whose name escapes me, he said he's not going to do it. He's jacked it in. Armit was actually the chair rather than the chief executive. The secretariat of the National Infrastructure Commission, there is a guy called James Heath, who's the chief executive. He was previously BBC director of policy. So he comes more from a sort of a government regulatory kind mm-hmm. of role. I think they're going to... Sorry, James, maybe a huge person. I don't know you. But I suspect they're going to need a bigger name, a bigger person to come in and do this job.
Mm.
And yeah, they might even bring in do something radical, like bring in a former Tory cabinet minister or big hitter to make it a bit more neutral. Or bring back Andrew Adonis. He's still working age,
oh,
I think.
Yes.
I don't think he's much older than me.
What's he doing these days?
Andrew Adonis, he's in the House of Lords.
Oh, right. Okay.
Eating big lunches, probably.
Well, something to look forward to in the spring or early summer.
I think it'll be summer. But in tandem with this organisation setting up, we also are expecting, which is a bigger part of the story, the new 10-year infrastructure plan.
Ah, yes.
Which everyone will get terribly excited about and go, isn't it fantastic that we've got a plan of action and we now know what we're doing and we can plan ahead accordingly and we can buy, you know, we now know that we have to buy so many tunnel boring machines because we know exactly which tunnels we're going to bore until in 3 years' time they tell us that actually we're not.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. Ten years, that's two parliaments. So,
At least.
At least. Yeah, yes.
Right, I'm sorry to sound cynical, but and the cynicism may not end. Just before we move off infrastructure, I was interested to read, okay, I'm being more cynical here, the new boss of HS2, oh lordy, what's his face? The guy from Crossrail. Mark Wilde, that's the chap.
Yeah.
I was thinking of Jack Wilde, he was the Artful Dodger, Mark Wilde.
Showing your age now, Phil.
He started as chief executive of HS2. They've been without a full-time chief executive for a year or more.
Mm.
The chairman had been stepping in as exec chairman or acting chief or whatever. Anyway, Mark Wilde finally started. I don't know exactly what he's been doing since he left, since Crossrail was finished at Elizabeth Line.
Mm.
And the first thing he's been told to do by the Department of Transport is basically do a, I think what they call in war films, a sit rep situation report on.
Oh, right, okay.
Where are we? How bad are things? And the first thing he says is the programme is in, quote, in a very serious situation that requires a fundamental reset to enable it to be delivered to the lowest feasible cost. It's too late to deliver it to the lowest feasible cost, as the previous chairman's already told us, when they're spending £100 million on bat tunnels and things.
Yes.
Which apparently don't even keep bats out. So it's all about the cost. There have been issues with structures having to be rebuilt and reconnected and wells going wrong and this sort of thing. On the whole, for the scale of its size, I don't think it's been a huge catastrophe. I think it's just been a victim of circumstances, my broad take on it. And I can't help thinking there's an element of expectation management on Mark Wilde's part and on the part of the new Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, who's also really slagged off what's gone before at HS2.
Yeah.
There have been significant delivery issues, cost underestimation, multiple causes of problems, blah, blah, blah. It's all been completely unacceptable, she says. So both the politician in charge and now the executive in charge of the project are both saying everything that's gone before has been dire and terrible and rubbish.
Mm.
And it's a bit like when a new chief executive comes into a company, the first thing they want to do is pile into the accounts all the provisions they can and all the bad stuff and all the write-offs and whatever. And preferably, you know, come up with a negative number, a loss for their first year. So that in their, you know, their second year or their first full 12 months in charge, they can say, look how I turn this business around. Look how good things are now. So if you can make things look as bad as possible when you start off, where you are in 12 or 24 months' time will look that much better by comparison.
Yeah, it makes totally good sense. I mean, it doesn't help that HS2 itself, its press office, recently posted a story online, I think sent out a press release as well, basically just enumerating all the great achievements over the past year or so. You know, how, you know, they've done, what is it, more than 50% of all the tunnelling, and they've moved 90 million tons of soil and all the rest of it. And just really talking up all the achievements so far.
That's fair enough. I don't mind that.
No, that's fine. But it doesn't really chime, as far as I can tell, with this rather downbeat assessment.
Oh, by Mark Wilde.
It's terrible. If things were really as bad as he would have us believe, then surely we wouldn't have all these great achievements to list. I don't know. Just it sounded like mixed messages to me. Anyway, I mean, I think the fact that HS2 is I don't know, damaged goods, if you ask me, because of course it's, if you compare it with the original concept, it's just a really pale shadow of its former self. It just isn't going to be what it was meant to be. And I think as when I was talking to you the other day, you made the point that the emphasis, the sort of raison d'etre of HS2, sort of rather gradually and almost imperceptibly changed from high speed rail, which is after all what HS2 is supposed to mean. It's not so much about high speed, but high capacity. And it's easier to justify it from a point of view of high capacity because, of course, you know, the West Coast Main Line and all the other main rail routes are oversubscribed, apparently. And it's crowded and we need to be able to move more people more efficiently. So they can say that HS2 will actually help to achieve that. But I mean, traveling at high speed from London to Birmingham, high speed doesn't really work over such a short distance, if you ask me.
Do you think a rebrand is in the offing then?
Well, HC2, high capacity 2.
Well, presumably once it's built, it won't be called. I mean, it's like the HS1 is now called. Is it now called a Javelin line or something?
Is it?
Or are those the trains that run on it?
I always used to call it the CTRL, the Channel Tunnel Rail Link.
That was before it was built.
That was before it was built.
HS1.
Yeah.
But I suspect by the time it's finished, it'll be far enough in the future that it'll be. We've already got the Elizabeth line, so it'll become the Charles line. But anyway, that was infrastructure year ahead. I mean,
yeah,
some of it. Oh, lots more to talk about infrastructure. But I was going back to what I was talking about, the government actions and recommendations, actions and things in the works, in the pipeline. Another one is, said recommendations, that's because there's a report coming out by July, it is due, from the Newtowns Commission panel, whatever they're called, Newtowns Task Force, that was commissioned in July 2024 to identify sites for big new conurbations that could take more than 10,000 new homes. This is a task force chaired by the former Birmingham City Council chief exec, Michael Lyons, with economist Kate Barker as his deputy. And the suggestion, the prompting from government whether to look at is mostly looking at urban extensions and regeneration schemes, quote, work with the grain of development in any given area, rather than, you know, plonking a completely new town in the middle of Dartmoor or something. So it'll be, you know, Ebbsfleety type of things that we've had in the past, I guess. So that's going to be interesting. That's going to get the construction industry very excited because they've been told they're going to say yes to plans. Local authorities are going to have, we are told, power taken away from them. This is going to go to the infrastructure. Oh Lordy, who determines the development consent orders? The Infrastructure Planning Commission, is that what it's called? But the development consent order people.
Yeah,
the people who now determine power stations and motorways and so on. It'll go to them, they'll recommend to ministers, the ministers then say yay or nay, rather than go to local authorities. So these new towns will bypass local democracy altogether, and then suddenly the government realises it's got itself in a right old stink and it'll have to completely rethink things. And in 10 years' time, we'll be back here exactly where we started. That's my prediction.
Occasionally, the topic of, well, I say occasionally, almost regularly, the topic of new towns raises its ugly head because, well, not necessarily ugly, of course. Some new towns are quite nice. Can't think of any offhand. But we've got this chronic housing shortage. Cumbernauld? Was that a new town?
Is that nice?
I don't know. Never been there. It's near Glasgow, isn't it?
Somewhere like that.
What's the one in Dorset that the
Poundbury.
Poundbury, that's supposed to be pretty, but I'm not sure it's
not exactly it's a new town, like though, is it?
No, it's not really. No, it's but no, I mean, well, in Garden City, there's a new town for you. That's a proper new town. You know, Milton Keynes, places like that. We've written about this in the past. In fact, before we started recording this, I was looking for a feature which a colleague of ours wrote for the magazine a few years ago, and I cannot find it anywhere in the archive about how renewed emphasis on finding sites for new towns, and the Conservative government is probably must have been at least 2019 or earlier, I guess. The government was rolling out plans for these new, or at least sort of mooting ideas for new towns, and then they just all disappeared. Nothing happened. And you mentioned Ebbsfleet just now. I mean, did they ever build Ebbsfleet?
There's a lot has been built there, but it's just, you know, drip, drip, drip. But a lot has happened over the past 10 years or 20 years. But it's funny you should mention an article recently written on this subject. That was a June 2014 issue of the Construction Index magazine.
You're joking. So, not that
10
long
and
ago,
a half
surely.
Years ago. I tell you, these things never go away. And by, you know, ignoring local democracy completely because it's been so difficult. They somehow think that's the answer. Not sure.
No, I'm not either. No, I think it's a very Labour Party thing to do, isn't it? To sort of centralise and take away, sort of power from sort of devolved, well, not from devolved areas, but from local authorities. I don't know, but if you're going to live in an area, you want decisions to be taken locally, don't you?
Yes, except the whole thrust of everything that Starmer and Rayner have been saying is that the national interest trumps, NIMBYs. It's how they see local people. You're all a NIMBY. If you don't like it, you're a NIMBY.
Yeah, that's true. Well, anyway, so we'll look forward to seeing how many new towns won't be built.
So that's going to be a big thing. I suspect that while the report will land on Rayner's desk, if she's still in that job in July, and no, I suppose she won't be, I don't think we will be allowed to see it for a while after that. I think it might be sat on while they try and work out how the hell they manage the fallout from it. another big controversial document which should be landing sometime this year is what used to be called the Future Homes and Building Standards, which was out for consultation under the previous Conservative government in 2023, which it now seems to be called the Warm Homes Plan. And this is all about the rules for when gas-fired boilers should be banned or not banned, or can you replace them, repair them? Should solar panels be compulsory in new builds? And all of this green stuff and how we get to net zero. There are reports in the paper this week that the ban on gas boilers, Ed Miliband, is rowing back on that in the face of lobbying from vested interests. So however that falls, there are going to be people crying foul. There are going to be people saying that's completely unreasonable because you're rowing back on net zero, or because you're imposing impossible demands on an industry which cannot deliver because we don't have the product or the staffing to deliver. So those are just three of the things I'm looking forward to. Anything you're looking forward to in 2025?
I'm looking forward to going on holiday, Phil.
Oh, where are you going? When? It's January. You can't go on holiday. Yeah.
Actually, I'm going on holiday next week.
How are you? How fabulous. Where are you going?
Going to Tenerife. It's just for a week, Phil. It's cold and wet down here in Devon. Not as cold or as wet as it is in other parts of the country. But Mrs. Taylor doesn't like the Devon winters, so she's going off for a whole month, and I'm going to join her for the first week. So,
If I was going away for a week, I think I'd rather go to Devon than Tenerife, because I would say it's better the Devon you know.
Well, yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Well, I'll report back when I return. I've never been there before. But let's get back on topic, shall we?
Right, where are we? To summarise, the three big government-y type things, amongst many that I think we'll be seeing this year, the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority with a new 10-year infrastructure plan, we've got the New Towns Task Force reporting, and we've got the Warm Homes Plan, and there'll be all sorts of other things. Let's get the crystal ball out. So those are things that we've been told are going to happen. They may or may not happen. One of the biggest things that we discussed in our last podcast, the biggest thing to happen in 2024 for the construction industry was the collapse of ISG. And it wouldn't be a huge surprise to see another major construction company go under in 2025, because that tends to happen. It's a high-risk business. The market's volatile.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was having a look at the Construction Watch, the credit rating
company
agencies.
Watch.
Is that
company
the
watch.
Correct way to describe? I'll say that again. I was having a look at the Company Watch ratings of various construction companies. The Company Watch, you're familiar with this organization,
yes,
aren't you, David? Is it right to call them a credit rating agency? Is that what they exist for?
No, I don't. I actually, what do I call them? They're a financial analytics company, basically. They're not just sort of focusing on a company's credit worthiness, but they look at the way a company It's an interesting, they've got an interesting algorithm. In fact, we used to deal with them many years ago. We had a sort of an interaction with them. And then we sort of lost touch with them. And we're back working with them again. And they've developed several more sort of metrics in ways of looking at a company and measuring its financial health, basically, how efficient it is, how financially sound it is, how secure, is risk of, how big is its risk of insolvency, that kind of thing. And their biggest product and their original product is the H score, which is just short for health score. And they just look at all the numbers, do a bit of number crunching, and their clever computer spews out a number which rates them according to their financial health on this simple sort of 0 to 100 scale. They've also got a couple of other, they've got several other ways of looking at a company, two of which we also use. We borrow from Company Watch. They provide us with the details. And one is the probability of distress. Now, don't ask me how any of this is computed or calculated, because it's far too complicated and arcane for me to understand. But the H score tells you how healthy the company's finances are. The POD, probability of distress, I think looks a little bit deeper and across a broader range of factors to see what other sort of opportunities, risks and opportunities might be impacting that company. So it might be external factors like, economic things, such as, that kind of thing. So the POD is another measure of a company's health. And then the one which I find most interesting, well, I say it's not necessarily the most interesting, but it's certainly unusual, is the text score. And this, I suppose, you and I would appreciate, sort of working in the publishing industry, is actually an analysis of the language used in the company's annual reports. And basically what the Company Watch algorithm does is go through the annual report for each company and basically highlights certain key terms, like the obvious ones like profit and loss and sort of turnover and things like this. And it basically looks at how often certain words occur in the annual report. And these, according to Company Watch, give you a sort of subliminal indication of what's going on in their own minds, what their expectations are. So the text score is also on a 1 to 100 scale. And that shows you if you've got a high text score, that's good. Same with the H score. If it's a high H score, then it's good. If it's a low H score, below 25 is considered to be the danger zone. So if you get an H score below 25, then watch out. The probability of distress is more a percentage thing, and obviously the higher that is, the more dangerous the or perilous the company's position. The text score is also, rather, as I say, like the H score, the higher it is, the more healthy the company appears to be. So Company Watch do this for any company they tend to look at, and it's interesting to see who's up and who's down here. Because, for example, in our top 100 feature, which we published last September, so these are historical figures. I mean, we can't give you their current H score or POD or anything like that at the moment. These are the most recent ones that we've published. Thomas Armstrong Holdings is a particularly healthy looking company. It's got an H score of 96 and a POD of 0.031, which is fraction of a 0.03%.
That's safer than the Bank of England.
Yeah, pretty much so. You look at the bottom.
Can I buy shares in Thomas Armstrong?
I don't know, ask them. F.P. McCann is another one. C.J. O'Shea, OHOB Holdings and Hill Holdings. These are all the top five. Text score is slightly different, actually. As I say, both H score and POD, Armstrong, McCann, O'Shea, OHOB and Hill, they're all in top five. From the text score measures, Lindham Group has the highest text score. Well, actually, it's equal with Hill Holdings. A&H Construction and Development's Holdings, which isn't a company I'm particularly familiar with. They've got a text score of 94, which is pretty good. Caddick is also there. It's number four with a text score of 86. And Balmer and Kirkland have a text score of 83. So they're obviously feeling fairly robust at the moment. And it's interesting to note because we also use the Company Watch metrics in our regular sector focus feature in the magazine, that the tech score doesn't necessarily correlate with the other two measures, because a tech score tends to be a sort of a subjective measure. You know, that's basically based on what the company is saying rather than what Company Watch is deducing from its figures. So that's quite interesting.
Two caveats I would add, you mentioned one of them already about Company Watch. I'm not as familiar as you are with the particularly probability of distress or the tech score. I know about the H score, the health profile, and I've reported on those sometimes.
Yeah.
But first thing to note is they only ever look. This is not kind of like a running commentary on, you know, if someone puts out a profits warning, Company Watch doesn't suddenly change all its metrics. It's just only when each time the latest accounts are filed once a year, they will crunch the numbers and say, right, as of this date,
yes,
this is what's going on. So, you know, for example, if you look at Morgan Sindall Group, their report financials June 30th to 30th of June 2024, we've got them, and so they're there.
Yes.
Whereas you look up another company like, Tilby Douglas, December 2023, yeah, which is a year ago now. So if you look at what's happening to Tilby Douglas on the Company Watch dashboard, it's sort of a year out of date. That's point one.
Yeah.
Point two is the H score is a great snapshot of saying whether this company has got work to do.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily. There have been plenty of companies who have bumped along in the danger zone of Company Watch and carried on, you know, piddling along and doing okay. Mm. ISG was not in the danger zone. It's hovering there or thereabouts. It actually had an H score of 25 on the cusp when it went under. Mm. But that was a score based on December 2022. And, of course, it went under in 2024.
Yeah.
It's not an absolute figure, but looking at H scores, there are two major construction UK main contractors, tier one contractors, that have not got terribly healthy H scores.
No.
Langer Rourke has an H score of 8 out of 100, given that anything under 25, as you said, is danger zone.
Yeah,
and Tilby Douglas, H score of 11.
Mm.
Both of those are significantly improved from the year before. The Lange O'Rourke score is as of results posted on up to March 2024. But in March 2023, Lange O'Rourke's H score was 4.
Yeah.
I mean, almost zero. Whereas Tilby Douglas in December 2022 was 2, which is even more almost zero.
It wasn't Tilbury Douglas back then, though, was it?
Well, yes, it was still in Interserver. It did go under. Yeah. It was wound up. But what I would say about both those companies, they are at least moving in the right direction.
Yes.
And there have been rumblings of good noise from them. But just a bold look at those numbers would kind of lead one to think that if you're trying to spot potential for big crashes this year, those numbers kind of suggest that they might be in the frame.
Yeah.
But things are always changing and moving. I think I hope those two companies are moving in the right direction, because that's the story they've been telling us. Lange Rourke, interesting that they've just handed over the new Everton football stadium.
Yes, that's Liverpool. Right.
And that, I don't know how much they bid and how much it costs them, precisely, but indications are that that has been a successful project for them. In a way, by contrast, that another stadium for Lang, when it was John Lang Construction, wasn't. If you go back to, is it like, it's cusp of the millennium, because it's called the Millennium Stadium, I think, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, in Cardiff. Yes, in Cardiff,
The big Cardiff Stadium, which effectively brought John Lang Construction down, and on the back of that, Ray O'Rourke bought the company for just a pound, famously. Yeah,
that's right.
So I'm hoping that we won't be reading that actually a stadium has brought Lang down again, but rather a stadium has helped revive Lang, yes, will be the story.
Well, that would be much better, wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, I mean, Lang O'Rourke, I'm not really that familiar with their day-to-day activities. I mean, obviously, they're a big Tier 1 contractor, but they always seem to be fairly, I always get the feeling that they're fairly robust and active. And, you know, Ray O'Rourke, I think, is a fairly clever operator. So I'd be surprised if they really got into serious trouble. I mean, they've been divesting of their overseas businesses, though, haven't they? They got rid of their Australian division.
Yes, I believe you reported that. I tend not to concentrate much on what's going overseas, but I think that's the case.
Maybe they're just sort of retrenching, focusing more on the European and UK activities.
Well, this is a particularly interesting number that Company Watch throw up. As of 10 months ago, at the end of their last financial year, Lang O'Rourke PLC net worth. Guess what their net worth might have been?
God knows.
Minus 308 million.
Bloody hell, really?
Minus.
How does that compare to other Tier 1 contracts?
Compare that, well, net worth of Morgan Sindall, 580 million at the end of last financial year. Balfour Beatty, nearly 1.2 billion. I mean, ISG, when it went down, net worth 156 million.
Wow.
Interestingly, but we mentioned Tilby Douglas, their net worth also negative, minus 70 million. So that's, you know, I don't know how a company with a negative net worth of such magnitude ticks over, but I think it's all about cash flow, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, Tilby Douglas, if somebody had asked me, you know, how well is Tilbury Douglas doing? My instinct would have been to say that, well, they're doing a lot better than they were when they were part of Interserve. You know, Interserve was a complete dog's breakfast, wasn't it? And, you know, Tilbury Douglas, I sort of saw it as the phoenix rising from the ashes sort of thing. And in fact, I think we rather sort of celebrated the fact that, you know, Tilbury Douglas had returned to its roots. It even returned to its old historic name.
And return to profit.
And return to profit, yeah. So I wouldn't have picked out Tilbury Douglas as being a particularly vulnerable company. But I suppose you can't ignore the figures. If this is, and you know, we have faith in Company Watch's algorithms, absolutely. And you know, it's a successful organisation, which is trusted by an awful lot of people with far more at stake than we have. So you've got to take notice of something like that.
Okay, here's the explanation for the low H score of Tilbury Douglas. Amortisation and impairment of intangibles.
Mm-hmm.
Minus 938,000. Okay, it's less than a million. I'm thinking that was going to be a billion. It's not. Okay. It's nearly a million. Okay, that's not, I mean, it's not great, but it's not disastrous. Working capital, minus 92, that is million, minus 92 million pounds working capital. So,
Okay.
I'm just reading out numbers here from the screen. I'll tell you a company that won't be going bust this year.
Go on.
It's a Manchester-based company, not particularly huge, BCEGI, Construction UK.
This wonder is, what their H score's like.
It's not great, actually. Their H score is 7.
Oh, right.
That's based on their 2022 results. It's now just filed its 2023 results. Company Watch haven't quite caught up with them yet. I'm sure they'll be updating soon. I suspect their H score will be nearer to zero than it was last year.
Yeah, but not to worry.
But not too early. They've doubled its revenues. I mean, it's not a huge company, but doubled its revenues from about 24 to 48 million in calendar 2023. But its losses widened from about 5 million to 8 million. Total equity in the business, minus 6.9 million. But it doesn't matter because it's owned by the People's Republic of China's Assets and Administration Commission of the State Council.
Which has deep pockets. So,
they basically say in the annual report, these are difficult times. Everything's very economic uncertainty. It's all, you know, all really bad. But we can always get finance via intercompany loans to operate for the foreseeable future.
So basically they're unsinkable.
So for as long as the People's Republic wants a presence in the Manchester construction scene for whatever reason, best known to itself. I should say it does pay tax, the British government, so that's all good stuff. We're taking money out of China at the same time and not sending any back, so it's not making any money. So maybe it's a good thing. We should get more Chinese construction companies over here to lose money and still pay tax.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. They've had a few changes at the top of the organisation, haven't they? Well, didn't their chief executive leave or something? I mean, if you look on Companies House, most of the people who are involved, most of the directors in that company have Chinese names. So they are sort of presumably Chinese residents. But there are one or two...
they might be UK residents, but Chinese nationals.
Well, Chinese nationals. There are one or two sort of more sort of European names. But I think that I'm sure I saw recently that one of the top people has left and been replaced by somebody sent over from China. But I mean, it is clearly it's a Communist Party of China vehicle, and it's got a little foot in the door of the UK construction industry. And I suppose, I don't know, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. I mean, people were worried about Huawei and what they might be doing over here. Should we be worried about Chinese government-owned contractors, you know, sort of driving a wedge into the construction industry over here?
Now, you mentioned change of the directors. That did happen in 2024. After the 2023 results, the year closed and they looked at the bosses looked at the numbers, the bosses back home looked at the numbers. There were cutbacks and boardroom changes with new directors brought in. Yeah. But, you know, steady as she goes, we'll keep doing what we're doing.
What do they build? What have they built?
Nothing huge. I think they're doing a regeneration scheme in Rochdale. Is it... Okay. Wigan, I beg your pardon.
Right.
Wigan Galleries, a shopping centre. They were involved in the first phase of that, overseeing the demolition. And that's now a Galliford Tri project. I don't know whether the Chinese were only put in to start it off or whether they were thrown off the job or walked away from it or whatever. But it began as a Beijing construction job. They did Middlewood Locks, a bit mixed-use development in Manchester, bits of that. So yeah, it's essentially Greater Manchester type of stuff that they do, and not huge amounts.
No, their turnover about 50 million.
I think I said 48 was didn't 48, okay. this time around.
Yeah, one to watch, I'd say.
or just listen to.
Yeah.
Time is flying, as it will do all year.
Yeah.
Any other business, David?
Well, only something which just caught my eye. It's not a story that I've got any intention of covering in the magazine. I'm sure you're not going to cover it online either. It was something sent in from National Highways because what's that program? BBC program called Digging for Britain.
Oh, archaeology. We like archaeology.
We do like archaeology. And it's got the ubiquitous...
Seven, it stops jobs going ahead.
Yeah. Professor Alice Roberts, you know, the leather-clad academic. It was on last night. I didn't watch it. But it wasn't so much the story I was interested in. The interesting thing, I mean, it is interesting, definitely, if you're interested in archaeology, was that there's this National Highways Road upgrade project somewhere up in East Anglia near Peterborough, I believe, on the A47. And they've unearthed a hand-carved Roman stone coffin. And it's, you know, it's almost completely, it's completely intact. It's quite an impressive artifact. They've dug that up. I don't think there was anything in it.
Must have been a pothole.
Must have been, yeah. Anyway, big stone coffin carved out of solid stone. But the thing which caught my attention, probably this isn't what I should have focused on, because a bit flippant, I suppose, but they said it was big. It weighed 750 kilograms, which, according to the National Highways press release, is about the size, it's as heavy as a fully grown male polar bear. And I just saw that and I thought, that is something that everybody in this country can completely relate to, you know. Oh, that big. Okay, as big as a male polar bear. And I thought there must be a more appropriate.
I was thought a Ford Focus or something.
Well, exactly. Ford Focus actually does weigh a bit more than that. But a cart horse. I'm sorry, but I Googled this. An adult male polar bear can weigh anything between 300 kilograms and 800 kilograms because it's feast or famine up there in the Arctic Circle. Yeah. You know, in the summer the ice is melting and they can't catch the seals and they get very skinny and they're very small. But of course, in the winter when food is plentiful, they just gorge themselves. You know, these great big fat polar bears that weigh sort of up to 800 kilograms. But that's a huge range, 300 to 800 kilograms.
Hang on, I thought the other way around. I thought it'd be much easier. They eat fish, don't they? You could get all the fish in the summer when the ice has melted.
No, they don't really eat fish. Seals, walruses, and beluga whales. There we are. Wow. They like a lot of meat. There's no doubt about it. So that's the size of an adult male polar bear. It could be anything between 300 and 800 kilograms. And I thought a much better metric would be a cart horse, because your average cart horse weighs anything between 640 and 910 kilograms, which is a much narrower range.
That's still a huge bird.
Well, yeah, not as big. But, I mean, you know, bang in the middle of that is about 750 kilograms.
Well, there must be something that weighs whatever this stone coffin weighed, which would be a better thing to say. It weighed, you know, the same as the entire All Blacks front row or something.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I suppose because with your journalist hat on, we're quite used to, especially in popular journalism, these sort of fun metaphors.
Double-decker buses.
And football pitches.
And whales.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's just, you know, back garden the size of two football pitches or, yeah, so, you know, I don't know. Yes, or so many Eiffel Towers and that kind of thing. But these are things which people are familiar with and can relate to and actually, you know, use as some sort of measure. But, I mean, the weight of
that. Even Eiffel Towers is dumb because if you ask me how tall is an Eiffel Tower, I'd go, is it 300 foot? I don't know, 80
yeah,
metres?
Good,
no idea.
Good question. No, I suppose once upon a time it was probably the tallest structure in Western Europe. So people would think, blimey, two Eiffel Towers, that's really tall. But I don't know. It just seemed to me an utterly eccentric metric to employ.
Because it's so variable as well. It's quite useful though, because then whatever, if you promise to, you know, deliver something as heavy as a polar bear.
Yeah.
And the person's disappointed, you can say, well, that's what a polar bear weighs in the summer.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so quite useless, really. But there we are. I mean, from now on, I bet I'm going to spot all sorts of things which would compare to polar bears or, you know, the length of a walrus or, you know, the width of a giraffe, something like
that. I'm going to make it my mission within the next week or two to crowbar some quirky animal into a news item as an analogy for a comparator, I think is the right word, isn't it? It's a comparator for the size of something.
That's a good idea. We're going to offer a prize for the listener or reader who spots it. A mention on the podcast.
What can we offer? I don't think we've got anything to offer, have we? We can certainly give you a name check.
Yes, definitely. Or an unwanted Christmas present. So there we are. Yes, stone coffins are now measured in comparison with polar bears.
Yeah, right. Okay, I need to get on, and I think so do you, David. 2025, who'd have thought it?
I know.
We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, all being well, everyone. Thank you for listening. Get in touch with us with your predictions of the year. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But for another session, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.